Me oh me, oh my oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Welcome to Western Skies, KRCC's news and culture magazine that takes a look at issues facing Colorado and the West. This month, we're exploring gender and sexual identity. We'll talk about social constructs of gender.
The only time that becomes a question is when they're doing gender in a way that we have not yet sanctioned as okay.
Explore the sexualization of girls.
Femininity has come to be associated with sexiness.
And here's some related poetry.
Little man's got to be tough and he can't learn to cry because he might die wiping eyes when bullets fly.
All that and more coming up in this edition of Western Skies. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Out here on the front range, looking for a good old time. Me and my friends are headed a little further on down. Me, oh me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for tuning in to Western Skies, a collaboration between the news department and the Big Something here at KRCC. I'm Andrea Chalfin. As the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, last month, in many ways the gay rights movement seems to be pushing forward faster than many had anticipated. Some are already turning toward other complex issues like gender. This month's Western Skies brings together a number of community perspectives on an issue that can confuse even those who study it. Please note, some content may be considered unsuitable for sensitive listeners. For our roundtable, KRCC's Noel Black sat down with Heidi R. Lewis, assistant professor of feminist and gender studies at Colorado College, attorney Julie Wolf, and reporter Stephanie Earls with the Colorado Springs Gazette.
The first question I want to ask, and I'm going to direct this to you, Heidi, would you define gender, and particularly will you make a distinction between gender and sexuality? Because I think that's something that confuses a lot of people.
Sure. I understand, talk about, and think about gender in two parts. One being the way that we're sort of socialized to understand gender, and the other part being the way that we embody gender. And by socialization, of course, I mean what happens from the moment that your parents know that you're a girl or a boy, and sort of making decisions about the way they'll dress you, the toys that you will play with, and things like that. So they're in essence, and not just parents, of course, commercials and schools where they divide boy, girl, all those institutions then socialize us to perform gender in a certain way. As we get older, we start to make decisions about how we will embody gender. It's different from sex and sexuality in that way, sex organs being those biological organs that you're born with. And we know now more than we ever have, I think, that some people embody gender in a way that does not necessarily correlate with the traditional way in which their organ has decided their gender. So you have people who are born male doing femininity, people who are born women doing masculinity, and then sexuality, of course, being the way that you have sex. Which can be, you know, there are myriad ways to have sex and do sexuality despite or in spite of or because of the way you embody gender.
Julie, I wonder if I could ask you, you know, as someone who does family law and someone who handles cases with families that are either gay or lesbian or deal with transgender issues, is there a legal definition where gender is concerned that is either fixed or evolving? How do you understand it in as far as the law is concerned?
I'm not aware of any definition of gender within family law itself, but Colorado does have certain civil rights statutes that talk about gender, and they differentiate by referring to gender identity. As well as the assigned gender or the gender at which a child is assigned at birth, which mirrors what was just stated. So your gender identity then is the way in which the person perceives himself or herself, as opposed to their assignment at birth, which has to do with whether the birth certificate indicates male or female.
And this is a good place to turn to you, Stephanie, because you've been covering the Coy Mathis case, and I'm going to have you sort of outline that story a little bit. It's been a huge case. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and I'll let you talk a little bit about that. But I'm fascinated by this case in particular because in your article you mentioned that Coy began to express her gender at the age of 18 months, really. And I wonder if you could just go ahead and give us some background on that case.
Coy Mathis is a six-year-old transgender girl, and she was enrolled in Eagleside Elementary. And up through kindergarten, her peers accepted her as expressing herself as a little girl, even though she was born with male genitalia. And it really didn't present a problem because in kindergarten, I think the boys and the girls both use the same restroom. And it's I guess, gender neutral. And it didn't really present a problem at school for Coy until she entered first grade where the restrooms were segregated. And she initially used the girls' restroom without there being much of a problem. And then the administration towards the end of that school year, her first grade year, would no longer allow her to use the little girl's restroom. And that's what sparked the filing of a discrimination lawsuit with the district. Her parents filed that.
And what was the outcome of the discrimination suit?
The Colorado Division of Civil Rights a couple weeks ago, actually July 17th, came out with their decision in favor of the Mathis family. So they decided that the school district had discriminated against Coy in that case.
What in your understanding, I'm gonna look to you, Heidi, again, is what is the issue that comes up for people around gender issues like this? Like, I'm wondering, how is it that a six-year-old girl with male genitalia can inspire fear and outrage and really just such confusion? How do you read that?
I think this is a very multi-layered issue, and a lot of it stems from the fact that people have a certain lack of knowledge about these issues. When you sort of gauge popular opinions about these issues, people express fears about molestation and rape, which assumes in a way that males are inherently conditioned to rape. You know, I don't want a male using the female restroom because I'm scared of what will happen to me, which assumes that men are going to go in the restroom and rape women, even if they themselves identify as women. Additionally, you know, people have fear about violence, and rape is, of course, violence. But there's a lot of public opinion about it, and people will say things like, you know, what if I'm attacked in the bathroom? If we let men in there, what's going to happen? And so I think, you know, I'm sort of eager for men to sort of step up and start to ask questions about why they're being perceived in such a way that, you know, a transgender girl using a woman's restroom invokes fear about violence and rape and all these things that there is no evidence to prove. So I think the reason why there's a lot of backlash about transgender individuals is because people are scared of things that don't exist because they don't know about, you know, these things in such a way. So that's just one aspect of it, I think, but it's one of the biggest that I would argue.
Julie, you obviously have dealt with cases where there are gender issues involved in custody of children, for example. Can you talk about some of what you've seen where people's fears or reactions get involved in these legal disputes?
Yes, I agree that a lot of people's reactions have to do with ignorance. And so if we don't understand something, if we don't know very much about something, we tend to be frightened about it. And the transgender topic has been hiding for a long time, and it has not taken the forefront. So at one point in time, people didn't think it was very common for maybe husbands to beat their wives, and that was just a very hush-hush subject. And then I remember even one of the Supreme Court justices mentioned that he had never met a gay person when two of his primary staff were gay men who had never come out to him. And then there's an issue here where, since people don't know what transgender is, I think they become freaked out that something bad will happen. It's just a general reaction. And then people also don't understand. They think, well, why would parents do this to a child to make her think that she's the wrong gender, without recognizing that there are issues that science doesn't fully understand yet that cause little children to feel, some of them, to feel that somehow their body doesn't match their emotions as to who they think they are. That's the gender identity issue. So it really comes down to trying to help other people, whether it's a custody evaluator or a judge or even the soon-to-be ex-spouse, better understand what's going on so that they don't end up imagining this host of frightening possibilities that have nothing to do with reality. And I think that in the next 10 years or so, we're going to realize that there's a certain segment of the population that are transgendered, and it won't flip us out so much. We'll just accept it. It's some people have diabetes, and some people are transgendered, and some people have blonde hair, and it's just a reality of life. It's not something that people have to become frightened about, but it's such a stigma right now that there are issues that need to be addressed through education.
Stephanie, I wonder if you could talk about just what were some of the reactions from people that you spoke with to Coy Mathis? What were their fears, and what did you hear people articulating in terms of why they didn't may not have wanted their children to share a bathroom with a transgender girl?
You know, I don't have any – didn't hear any responses that spoke particularly to that. And from my reading of the determination by the Civil Rights Division, that neither the family nor the school received complaints from parents that really had to do with Coy using the little girl's bathroom. Actually, the biggest question, I guess the question I get most frequently from people who've called in to talk to me at the paper about it is just how did the parents know that this is what she was expressing at when she was 18 months old before she could really talk and say, I think I'm a girl. I think this is not who I feel like I am, not this body. So that's the biggest question people have posed to me is that how could her parents possibly have known at 18 months?
One of the things that comes up for me when I think about these things is, well, okay, Coy Mathis is expressing that, you know, she wants to be a girl, but is it just male and female genders? And do we get kind of trapped into that even where transgender issues are concerned? How do we think about it? What if it's something in between or, again, just where gender expression is concerned?
Well, no, that is a great, great point that I've been thinking about since we've been talking. If I could have a second to just give a quick narrative that helps me sort of situate my thoughts on this issue. My son and daughter are 19 months apart. When my son was 22 months old, I remember sitting there with his baby sister. She was 3 months old, and he was watching television, Nickelodeon, some, you know, child-friendly programming, and he started to say, Chase, to his little baby sister who can't even talk. He says, Chase, that's what you want. Mommy, that's what I want. Chase, that's what you want. And I'm like, what? And I asked him, what are you talking about? He was talking about the TV, commercials, toys, telling me and his baby sister what they wanted based on the way that the commercials gendered my kid. I didn't even get a chance to talk to him about masculinity and femininity. TV forced me to have that conversation with my not yet 2-year-old son before I was ready. And so when the parents are talking or when other parents are concerned about how, you know, these parents knew that their child was going to express gender in a certain way at 18 months, would you ask the same question if your 18-month-old was going to express gender in the way that they were supposed to? No. The only time that becomes a question is when they're doing gender in a way that we have not yet sanctioned as okay. So when TV tells my son, boys play with Tonka trucks. Now, if the girls are going to play with Tonka trucks, they got to be pink. Or, you know, boys are going to play with science toys. Girls are going to play with dolls. Girls are going to play with kitchen toys. Girls are going to play with baby toys. You play with something else. It's no surprise to me why these parents, to me, it says that they were paying attention to their child and noticing that their child was interested in things that, you know, maybe they, based on society's determination, shouldn't have been. But why do we then, I ask, theoretically, ideologically, why do we keep assigning gender to things we do?
I want to move the conversation a little bit more towards what maybe would be more traditional gender issues, because one of the things that also happened was that the Pentagon announced that they would lift the 1994 combat exclusion rule and will begin to officially integrate women into the military, into active combat, I guess by 2016 is the official deadline. And again, here we're talking about a place where, traditionally speaking, gender is so differentiated, the military. You know, it's often thought of as a male domain, at least historically. Obviously, huge numbers of women have served in the military over the years, and yet now we're looking again at this very sort of central issue of combat. And I guess I just want to ask you all personally how that in your minds changes essentially, you know, what the male female gender roles are in our society, and how you even react to that. I guess Julie, I'll go back to you.
Oh, that's a big topic. Well, I think some of this comes down to the nature versus nurture dilemma that we've heard about for decades, in which the bottom line, I think, is that both contribute to one's identity. And so there are certain biological DNA, chemical, hormonal issues involved. During the feminist movement, a lot of us thought that if we just raise children in a gender-neutral way, that they will in fact turn out to be gender-neutral. And then, you know, a lot of these parents were shocked to find out that many of the girls really do prefer girly things, not that they would never cross over to some of the typically male things and vice versa, but that there's also environmental impacts. And I think when it comes to the decision for the combat in the military, I think that a lot of that comes down to economic equality and allowing women who have worked their whole lives to accomplish a certain goal, do not have to reach the so-called glass ceiling and then not take the next step when they want to, that women are just as capable as men to do certain things, or at least the women who want to pursue that career. And that finally the military is allowing those women to do so. And I think it just helps society recognize that while we still have ideas about girls and boys and male and female, that ultimately we are complete human beings who have a myriad of talents and that we should be allowed to pursue our talents.
Heidi.
One of the things that we know is that the ban was put in place banning women from combat because women were seen primarily as mothers. And so the government didn't want its women in combat because it risks their ability to produce the next generation of soldiers who should go to combat. And so now that the ban is lifted, one of the biggest things it does that I appreciate is it removes motherhood as the primary way in which women are identified and appreciated. I love being a mom with everything in me, but it is not and shouldn't be the only way in which my society values who I am. And so the ban for me was like a big moment for women in that we are seen as the multiplicitous beings we are and not just as moms, even though we don't mean to denigrate motherhood.
Stephanie, I want to ask you as a reporter, is there a learning curve for you in covering this issue? And do you think that that is also an issue for the media more broadly, is how to talk about these issues?
Well, I think there really is a pretty steep learning curve when it comes to this. Also, because I didn't want to go into it and write anything incorrect or offensive. You know, Koi is a transgender girl, not a transgender boy. Right. I mean, it's things like that. And you know, I had questions too when I first started writing about it. You know, how I wondered how a child at 18 months old was expressing her gender identity. And so really it was just – for me, it was just finding out as much as I possibly could about Koi and about what she'd gone through. And, you know, it's my understanding that when she was first expressing her gender identity as a girl, you know, it was nonverbal. It was in the toys that she chose, the people. She wanted little girl friends. And I mean, her parents didn't even they thought she might be transgender, but didn't really actually start considering it really until she was in kindergarten. And in one of Koi's classes, the teacher had the little boys line up on one side and the little girls line up on the other side of the room. And Koi went to the little girl's side. And when the teacher corrected her and had her go back to the other side with the boys, it really upset her, depressed her. It, you know, she was not having a very good school experience after that. And that's really when the parents were forced to start, hey, looking at this is our child. This is, we're going to have to start making some changes based on this. So really for me, it was trying to learn as much as I could about Koi and answer the questions that are the pretty obvious questions.
When it comes down to a lot of the confusion. It seems often to me that what we're talking about is language. It's about signals and words, pronouns. I want to ask you this, Heidi, as somebody who studies gender and feminism. What's the goal, or how do we move into a place where we have a more diverse language with which to address these kinds of ambiguities ultimately?
There are a couple things that Julie said. She mentioned compassion at some point. And it may sound fluffy and it may sound, you know, cheesy, but it really, really does take a kind of compassion that Stephanie is talking about as well when she talks about the way that she approached the story and really caring about the way that people see themselves, sometimes more than the way we see them. And that just really takes a kind of compassion that I think a lot of us, and I'm including myself, struggle with. You know, we have various pronouns now that we've introduced to our language to try to describe some of these ambiguities that you're talking about. We have Z instead of she and he. And a lot of times in the classroom and in the streets, I find people getting really frustrated and annoyed with having to care about how people want to be talked about. Why do I have to go through this stress of calling you what you want to be called? Well, we do it on a daily basis. It's just, when do we get annoyed with it? You know, when I walked into the room, Julie introduced herself as Julie and Stephanie introduced herself as Stephanie. And far be it for me to start calling them Tammy and Rebecca. I'm going to call them by the names they want to be called. So we do this on a day-to-day basis. It's just when it comes to certain issues, we get really annoyed because it disturbs the way we've understood our lives for all of our lives. You know what I mean? We've understood gender as male and female for hundreds of years. So now for us to be forced, you know, we feel assaulted. You're changing the way I think about and see and live in the world. And it's really uncomfortable when people get scared. But I think that's why the theoretical work is as important as the work on the ground. Not more important, not less important, but as important, because we can change policies all day long. We've had affirmative action for how many years? We still struggle with racism and sexism. So we've had the policy for 50 years. But people's minds and hearts are still stuck in the past. So we have to keep talking about it, even when it's uncomfortable, because that's going to be the catalyst for the real change, in conjunction with the policy changes and the legal changes and the on the ground activism.
That was Heidi R. Lewis, assistant professor of feminist and gender studies at Colorado College, attorney Julie Wolf, and reporter Stephanie Earls with the Colorado Springs Gazette. You can hear the full conversation online at krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies. Welcome back to Western Skies, where we're talking about gender and sexual identity. Just a reminder, some content may be considered unsuitable for sensitive listeners. Jim Parko is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and professor of economics and business at Colorado College. In this segment, Parko discusses how the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell has more to do with the redefinition of warrior culture than sexuality.
This morning, I am proud to sign a law that will bring an end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
When you look at repeal, it opens up this window into the paradoxical nature of military culture. And I think to understand that, you have to go back to 1993 when Don't Ask, Don't Tell came to be. Several things were going on when it became a political issue during Bill Clinton's time.
The issue is not whether there should be homosexuals in the military. Everyone concedes that there are.
The issue is whether men and women who can and have served with real distinction should be excluded from military service solely on the basis of their status.
First, when you look to public opinions, only about 40% of the United States electorate thought openly gay service would be acceptable. And then added on to that, there wasn't a lot of data of what openly gay service would do to the military. And the argument was, just based on the intuition of those in charge at the time, that we can't allow openly gay service. What was interesting over the last 17 years is we actually have data on both of those. Number one, public opinions have changed. Most of the public really don't care. They don't see it as a relevant issue, which is a large reason why the law changed. But more importantly, we actually had quite a bit of data because Israel, Great Britain, Canada, and Australia all repealed their gay bans since 1992. And in each case, the biggest story was really no story at all. But when you get to 2010, you still saw a group of people that were tenaciously holding on to these beliefs that we absolutely could not have openly gay service because it would, in fact, harm the culture of the military. It was really code for we have to protect this warrior mythology that is perpetrated over the years. So I think we need to go back 500 years and define what we mean by what it means to be a warrior. When you think of a warrior in this context, it conjures up this image of this bare-chested man on a white horse with a sword, you know, about to do battle in a physical contest of strength against an enemy. And in that context, it actually worked. And yet this warrior ethos has continued to persist until as recently as even World War II, where we're still doing this force-on-force battle. The difference is we're using machines, and we're fighting this interstate industrial war as compared to war on horses, but everything is still dominated by this warrior mythology that it really still is a contest of strength. At the same time we see, you know, during the industrial era, this rise of technology, and you forecast it even on to today, I mean, this idea of being in war, of the warrior doing heroic battle, it's more of a managerial ideal. No longer are the warriors valiant and heroes going out there on the battlefield, despite the fact that's the rhetoric that still persists. You actually have generals sitting behind computer screens watching large operations. We're fighting from Nevada-stan. In the 70s, Congress started appointing women to the military academies. And, you know, we saw a lot of problems with women in the military because, again, this warrior mythology, you know, if you nominate this image of this bare-chested male warrior in a physical contest, well, you know, women aren't as strong, they're not physically as capable, and you hear this rhetoric. But then you kind of project on what it takes to be a warrior today in this technological context, none of this really matters. And that's what's threatening to the military, is this warrior mythology that continues to persist. And yet when we reflect back of what it takes to win wars today, how do you win the hearts and the minds of the people? What are the qualities that really are instrumental in being effective? Compassion, warmth, good listening skills, understanding, a lot of the attributes that are typically associated with the female gender. When I look at the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and all that's happened in terms of technology development, I think it's a tremendous opportunity at an epic moment in our history to really redefine of what it means to be effective in war.
That was Jim Parco, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and Professor of Economics and Business at Colorado College. You can see the full micro lecture online at krcc.org.
Wading. Wading in a jungle's quicksand, he struggles to stand, staring stalemate at a fate of obliteration. Not knowing he could survive longer, just being still. I want to heal, reach down and rescue him, but holding on too tight, I just might stifle the breath, the life he clings so frantically to. 114 blocks south of Madison's concrete gardens, west of Pullman Porter's utopian borders, he is a stilettoed rose growing amidst broken glass dreams in guttered streams. He is wasting away like semen caught in the bellies of used condoms. The afterbirth of marred battlegrounds, I want to cradle his underweight 11-year-old body in kisses, restore innocence, but you suggest coddling him won't make a man of him soon enough. See, to survive this life, little man's got to be tough, and he can't learn to cry because he might die wiping eyes when bullets fly. He is running and running and running and running and running from what to try, buy, and the lies of predators. Hunting season is open, and lions are going after their own. This is our song.
Dr. C.J. Pasco, author of Dude, You're a Fag, has spent the past decade studying the relationships between teenage boys and their definitions of masculinity. In the following segment, Pasco talks about the relationship between gender, bullying, and sexuality.
When we talk about bullying, it seems incidental that many times when we hear stories about young people taking their lives due to homophobic bullying, that those kids are boys. And primarily straight-identified boys. Yet, when we look at the statistics about who is being bullied, it's often straight-identified boys harassing other straight-identified boys for being gay. So what is this about? What boys are trying to do as they bully one another is shore up contemporary definitions of masculinity. That is, boys will target other boys when they exhibit behaviors that are considered feminine, behaviors that are considered incompetent, when they are too touchy, when they are too emotional, and yes, when they exhibit any type of same-sex desire. When I talk to boys about the sorts of homophobic taunts that they deploy, they continually tell me that gay, fag, homo, queer are the worst insults you could deploy. But they simultaneously tell me that they're not actually about sexuality. For the most part, when I speak to young men and teenagers about gay rights and gay marriage, they support, the vast majority of them support gay rights, gay marriage, legal protections for gays. They aren't homophobic on a sort of structural level. So what they're actually afraid of and what they're policing in one another is this what I come to call the specter of the fag, right? This profoundly unmasculine man strikes fear in the heart of these boys, right? Because there's no way for them to solidly prove that they are not that man, right? So that the way they prove they're masculine is this continual rejection of the specter of the unmasculine man, which takes the form of homophobic taunts and epithets. A lot of this type of harassment takes place in boys' joking relationships. Think, for instance, about the film 40-Year-Old Virgin. There's that famously funny scene in which two men are watching a video game. And while they're watching this video game, they're teasing one another, joking back and forth, asking each other, "Know how I know you're gay?"
I'm gay for saying that.
You know how I know you're gay?
How? How do you know I'm gay?
Because you macrame'd yourself a pair of jean shorts.
You know, I know you're gay. You just told me you're not sleeping with women anymore.
You know how I know that you're gay?
How? Because you're gay and you can tell who other gay people are?
You know how I know you're gay?
How?
You like Coldplay. Oh, you're dead. You're dead.
Oh! Oh! Leave my torso alone, at least.
If you listen to their reasons about why they know the other is gay, it, again, has very little to do with sexuality, although that does come up once or twice. But the sort of things that come up are taste in music, the clothes they wear, the particular hobbies they engage in. So again, what these men are doing as they're joking back and forth is not necessarily policing heterosexuality, but policing masculinity. And I would say the particularly interesting thing about this scene is that it doesn't look like they're policing anything because they're just making jokes. And indeed, when we look at homophobic harassment among boys, a lot of that type of harassment happens in these joking relationships. And in some ways, I would actually say this is even more serious than the aggressive taunting we see happening, because the joking itself hides the seriousness of the deployment of these insults. So given that many of these bullying behaviors take place in boys' friendships, and many of these bullying behaviors are deployed not to police sexuality so much as they are to police masculinity, I think we might want to rethink this contemporary bullying discussion we're having on a national level. Because when we use the word bully, it does a couple things. First, it makes it seem as if there's this group of kids who are targeting this other group of kids, right? Which we know is not actually true. It's a much more fluid interaction in which at any given point a boy could exhibit bullying behaviors, and at another point he could be the target of bullying behaviors. Second, when we use the word bully to talk about kids' behaviors, it makes it seem as if they're doing something that is unique to childhood and not actually repeating, affirming, investing in all of these norms and expectations that we as adults are handing down. For instance, there's this fabulous picture that was taken on the deck of the USS Enterprise in 2011 with a bomb that was about to be dropped on Afghanistan. And on that bomb, soldiers had written, "Hijack this, fags." And it's doubtful that they thought the people they were going to drop the bomb on were actually gay, right? Indeed, they were trying to divest them of masculinity, much like boys are trying to do with one another. So it's not as if boys are exhibiting this behavior in a vacuum. Right? In many ways, they're repeating what we as adults are doing ourselves. And so if we change this discussion of bullying and possibly use more adult language to describe it, words like harassment, right? We might take these sorts of things more seriously, and we might stop telling kids, oh, it gets better when you get older, as if the adult world is so rife with equality, right? And instead, we could start thinking about ways we could change the sorts of cultural messages we're handing down to kids about gender and sexuality, kindness, generosity, and help them change the world from the bottom up instead of the top down.
That was Dr. C.J. Pasco, author of Dude, You're a Fag. You can hear the full talk online at krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies. Welcome back to Western Skies, where we're talking about gender and sexual identity. As a reminder, some content may be unsuitable for sensitive ears. Dr. Tomi Ann Roberts has been studying the question of the sexual objectification of females. In this segment, Roberts discusses the way the culture now encourages this kind of sexualization, even in young girls.
As a psychologist, I've always been really interested in what are the kind of psychic consequences for girls and women of existing in a cultural milieu where the female body is just sort of always scrutinized, always used to sell things from tires to shoes, and what that sort of means in terms of the lifespan development of girls and women over time. How do they incorporate a kind of sexually objectified standard into their own psyches, and what must that mean? I got a phone call from the American Psychological Association in 2005, and they asked whether I might want to serve on a task force. The APA will sometimes name task forces if they perceive that there's some kind of potential mental health risk out there. The task force was on the sexualization of girls. And the concern had become, are we seeing an increasingly sexually objectifying treatment of younger and younger girls? And what can we do about that? Is it the case that this is a problem not only were we asked to document the extent of the problem, but also should we be concerned about girls' own mental health? We had really identified three sources of the sexualization of girls. One is a cultural source. It's one that we're all becoming increasingly aware of. And so we examined research on marketing and products to girls. Something that's really interesting is the proliferation of what I would call kind of downsized stores and downsized magazines. So, for example, there's a store called The Limited. Suddenly, there was a store called The Limited 2, where you took adult women's clothing and merely made the sizes smaller. So Abercrombie came out with Abercrombie Kids. And so the downsizing of adult style clothing for youth, and particularly for girls. So there are a lot more of those stores available for girls. And also the downsizing of adult, highly sexualized magazines. And so one of the things we were surprised to discover is how often parents and teachers and many of the people who are supposedly looking out for the best interest of children are encouraging a hypersexualized persona in young girls. We found an example of a study of girls in kindergarten who, during dress-up play, were often encouraged by the teachers to strut their stuff when they're dressing up and to really, in other words, I think the idea here is that femininity has come to be associated with sexiness. And if femininity a generation ago was associated with domesticity, I think Naomi Wolf in her book The Beauty Myth convinced me that a cultural shift sort of happened and we now associate sort of idealized femininity not with domesticity as much anymore, but with sexiness. And increasingly, we're applying that sexy standard to younger and younger girls. Girls are not passive recipients of all these cultural messages. Girls are active agents. And I think we know from cognitive psychology, developmental cognitive psychology, that young boys and girls, once they know what their gender is, they're very motivated to be the best example of their gender. And if the examples of femininity around you are sort of a tarted up, kind of pornographized sexuality, then that's what you're psyched to be. So I've often told an anecdote of a time many summers ago when my family was living in Berlin for the summer, and my younger daughter, who was 7 years old at the time, we were on a streetcar and we were moving through the city, and we had come to a part of Berlin, it was Berlin after all, where prostitutes were soliciting openly. And I remember looking out the window, and my young daughter, 7 years old, was just really enchanted with these women. Some of them, of course, had long hair extensions, vinyl thigh-high boots. They were working the streets. And my daughter looked out the window, and she said, "Oh, Mommy, look, they're so beautiful. They look just like Bratz dolls." And in fact, they did look like Bratz dolls. Coming back full circle to that cultural contribution to the sexualization of girls. For my daughter, a Bratz doll was a beautiful image of femininity. And here she saw, walking the streets of Berlin, exactly that exemplary kind of sexed up femininity. And to her, that was beautiful.
That was Dr. Tomi Ann Roberts. You can hear the full micro lecture online at krcc.org.
She said she wanted to love black men, but just couldn't find them anywhere. So in the midst of her despair, I began to think, if I were to love black men, then I wouldn't pretend not to feel their pain. Knowing they are trying to maintain their heads above water, already being counted as sheep for the slaughter, coffins designed before their birth. So each day on this earth is their blessing, and it's no use in me stressing them out even further, but that's if I were to love brothers. If I were to love black men, then I'd protect them as much as I can while never denying one to be a man standing firm on his own, yet there to reverse a fall whenever called upon, I would be an asset. multiplying everything they begat into perpetual inheritances for our children's children. I would also be non-defiant, in compliance with natural balance and divine order of things, allowing him to be king, leading our families, knowing as queen they never would deny me anything or level of respect commanded for themselves. If I loved black men, then I would work to send them to heaven instead of constantly condemning them to hell with the vicious lies we tell, like there ain't no good brothers and I wish I wasn't your mother because you just like your no good daddy. I would work to make them more than happy, but filled with joyful elation, constructing salvation for our nation one black generation after another. If I were to love brothers, yes, I would be their keeper. But if I were to love black men, I would begin by loving myself, knowing my wealth is worth more than the rate of exchange of whips and chains, and never gain one reason to diss me or justify claims to call me out of my name due to my dress or countenance. They would desire to respect the complex essence of me, seeing self reflections. And no, I would not grow irate if eyes deviate to look at another sister, because the truth is, sisters are fine. And I know everything that's mine comes home with me. So you see, if I were to love black men, if we were to love black men, then this poem could never end and it would carry on in our actions.
UCCS Professor of English Alex Ilasova began following the four-year saga of the Dykes on Bikes trademark case when she was in graduate school. Here she examines the dynamics of power and masculinity in the framework of this landmark case.
Dykes on Bikes actually started in 1976, and they are and kind of evolved into the group that starts the Pride parades across the country. I think it was either 2001 or 2002. There was a woman in Wisconsin who was wanting to start a clothing line and name it Dykes on Bikes. And the San Francisco women's contingent, the Dykes on Bikes themselves, found out about it. She did stop, but to prevent this from happening in the future, the organization itself decided that they should trademark their name. And so they filed a trademark case with the U.S. Patent Trade Office. The U.S. Patent Trade Office refused the trademark Dykes on Bikes based on a section 2A, which states that people of reasonable sensibilities would find this term disparaging. And the problem with that interpretation is that the people who are labeling or naming themselves Dykes are the only ones who are the judge of whether or not the term is disparaging or not. But that's not the rule they applied, and so they found it disparaging and denied it. And in August of 2004, they filed for reconsideration and made the legal argument that they applied the wrong rule. And again, they were turned down. So they got denied a second time. And this time they resubmitted again, asking, I believe, for them to consider it under the appropriate rules, and also submitting testimonies, like 400 pages of expert testimonies talking about the evolution of language and specifically terms that minority groups reclaim to feel empowered. Again, the U.S. Patent Trade Office denied it. Prior to this, and even as this case was being considered by the U.S. Patent Trade Office, they approved marks like Cripple Old Biker Bastards and Homo Depot, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, made it. Queer as Folk went through the Patent Trade Office. And then there was stuff like, I mean, it was just crazy, the stuff that they let in that apparently wasn't disparaging. So there was a trademark that they approved called Whore. So it was just beyond figuring out, like, how did Dykes on Bikes become disparaging compared to something like Whore? So that was just bizarre. And then I started thinking, well, okay, it has to be the word dyke. That's the issue. About a year prior, they actually allowed the trademark Technodyke. So it wasn't necessarily the issue of the word dyke. That seemed to be what at least this officer at the U.S. Patent and Trade Office found disparaging. So what I started to examine was kind of the connection between our culture and our societal values and how we tend to reinforce gender and sexualities. And so when you put dykes with bikes, there's a whole mix that happens in terms of masculinity and femininity and who gets to be aggressive and who has to be submissive and who gets to be the bitch on the bike. So that's kind of where I went profiling not only just motorcycling, which is very masculine and very male, and but also who gets to be masculine and what happens when we challenge that. And this became kind of a real example of the ways we reinforce and try to norm each other. So finally they got the approval, and the process is once you get the trademark, it is open to the public for 30 days to see if anybody objects or if there's any kinds of issues. So a man in Dublin, California filed opposition papers on the grounds that it is anti-male hate march. And there was part of his opposition papers gave an example of being pushed off the sidewalk by a big butch or something, and so he's feeling threatened.
Nothing is more vicious than a scorned, guilt-ridden blonde.
And apparently the trademark was going to further allow women to push men off sidewalks. It actually had to go to the California Supreme Court to be heard and denied before this was over. A number of women who've written books about the shift that happened to them from wife and housewife and mother to when they purchased their bike. And it usually starts because the husband got a bike and he's having this kind of midlife crisis and he wants to feel young again, and so he gets a bike. And she stays home with the kids, and then at one point she goes, I don't want to stay home with the kids, I want to go on the bike. And so she goes on the bike with him and realizes, I want my own bike. And then she gets a bike, starts riding with her husband, and then eventually goes, you know what, I'm going to go by myself. And it's this incredible shift in terms of feeling capable and strong and secure that you get when you're in control of a bike. And I think in Western cultures, there's still a lot of resistance and discomfort with women feeling like they have agency, whether it's with reproductive rights or choices of motherhood or work. We are still very uncomfortable allowing that kind of freedom and individuality and agency. A motorcycle still seems like a really powerful way for women to feel that.
Me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western skies.
That was UCCS Professor of English, Alex Ilisova. For more, head on over to krcc.org.
Me, oh my, I'm looking at the western skies.
Thanks for joining us this month for Western Skies. The poetry you heard in this episode comes from Stephanie Rose, poet and professor of Women's and Ethnic Studies at UCCS. The poems are called Hunting Ground and Virtuous Woman and are from her book Stilettoed Roses Bleed. You can revisit them online at krcc.org. Western Skies is a production of KRCC News and The Big Something, produced this month by Noel Black, Craig Richardson, and Andrea Chalfin. Special thanks to the Haunted Wind Chimes for our theme music with lyrics and arrangement by Anea Lujan. For KRCC News and Western Skies, I'm Andrea Chalfin.